This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is the collected wisdom of Evan Dahl.
Okay.
Alrighty, so I'll get to what that actually means. I'm sure you have questions in a few minutes, but first we have some follow-up. So why don't you go first, Wolf?
Yes, that's a quick bit of follow-up on my floating point numbers, our leaky abstraction episode. That Matt Connolly wrote in, tweeted at us, mentioned that apparently the 6500 chip in the Apple II also had binary coded decimal support for addition and subtraction, of course, not multiplication, because I don't think it even had like support for multiplication, even you know, for non-binary coded decimal. I seem to remember you had to like do that all yourself. Maybe that's with division, but yeah, because man, division used to be really expensive.
So, yeah. I think so. Yeah. Yeah, so that was interesting. Okay, so I have two things. One, from our Click to Flash episode, episode 79, Click to Flash Behind the Music, I finally managed to get a photo of the Eddie.
Oh, yeah.
You guys won. So, and I tweeted that. So I will put a link to that in the show notes. You can have a look. It is in the possession of our friend, Simone yes. Manganelli. He did actually. I did manage practice? To trick him into pronouncing his name for me.
Like Rumpelstiltskin.
So he, so he pronounced it. You know, a decent pronunciation of his name. So I feel pretty confident now saying his name. And I think I would have gotten it right if I just hadn't sort of lost that one syllable in there. So yeah, you can have a look at that. And then the second thing was a little offhand thing. I did mention that the Jurassic Park quote about Unix, mm-hmm. where he says, you know, it's a Unix system. I know this. Mm-hmm. And I even have a link to it in the show notes for our last episode, I believe. No, I said, well, that, you know, that wasn't even Unix. And I'm kind of surprised that nobody brought this up, but it turns out it is Unix.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, so it's...
Was it an SGI box or something like that?
Yes. So what happened is it's the, what do they call it? It's a file manager. It's an experimental file manager called Fusion that let you see the file system in a 3D manner. And so it's not something that anyone else generally got to use because it was experimental. It was never shipped. But it was made by SGI for its IRIX systems. And, of course, IRIX systems are Unix. They were an offshoot of Unix. So, in fact, it is a Unix system. It's just – I mean, the funny part is, of course, that you wouldn't think it was Unix because it wasn't command line. But yes, it was Unix. So when we make fun of that poor young woman for that poor girl for saying that. She wasn't wrong. In any case. So, moving on. So, the first thing, Wolf, do you know who Evan Dahl is? Have you heard of the name?
I believe I have.
Yes. And so how have you heard of the name? You have probably heard of it because you saw, maybe you even listened to, the episode of the Debug Podcast. Now, the Debug Podcast, for those of you who don't know, is a tech podcast by Guy English and Rene mm-hmm. Ritchie. It's actually, let me see if I have the date down here. It was started in November of 2012, mm-hmm. which makes it a younger podcast than ours. However, if you were to add up their audio and compare it against our audio, I did not. My God, why would I do that? But I'm sure it would wind up that we would be significantly in the rear in that regard because their episodes are generally 2 to 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Whereas ours are more like 2 to 3 minutes now, like 45 minutes. And the reason they take so much time is because they have it's a tech podcast, but it's a little different than our tech podcast because they bring on a guest and then they just talk about their history. So most of the interesting stuff they talk about is the tech history, bits of tech background and history and all the interesting stuff that went on about things like, for example, they had my colleague at Black Pixel, Jeff McLeman, went on for a while to talk about his history porting the NT kernel.
Yeah, I would listen to that episode.
Yeah, no, that was a lot of fun. I would recommend it. Uh-huh. And so then, yes, they also interviewed Evan Dahl. Now, uh-huh. I had not heard of Evan Dahl. I do not know Evan Dahl from Adam. If he has a brother named Adam, you know, I wouldn't know. But he was on the episode, and I did find out that he worked at Apple on the original iPhone.
Yeah.
And he has started his own company with some other people, Flipboard. Uh-huh. And he's a developer there. So it was very interesting hearing about his background. And let's see. But the reason I bring it up is because I was listening to his episode and he just kind of tossed off as part of talking about his work and what he's done, a couple of maxims, a couple of aphorisms about development that I thought were interesting. So, you know, I was like, hey, this is kind of interesting. So after he got to sort of the second one, I was like, all right, I better write these down. So I started writing them down. There are three that we will talk about today. And you don't have to worry so much if you've already listened to that episode, because for that episode, it was mostly history. And these sayings were just kind of tossed off and then, you know, not really discussed all that much. But for us, they're going to be the whole point of the episode. So it's a bit of a different focus, won't be all that much overlap. Two of them are direct quotes, and another one is more of a paraphrase. So the first one is, code is a liability.
Yes. I think
did you listen to this?
I've used that phrase myself for a long time, so I don't know if he authored it, but I think it's kind of in the air type stuff. Yeah, but yeah, okay. I agree with that, but go ahead.
Well, let's see if you did the second one too. Ship the right bugs. Okay, yeah, I mean, this stuff is not the pinnacle of cutting-edge thinking. It's just interesting stuff to talk about. And the third one was, again, more of a paraphrase, and it comes down to that advice on process is about as helpful to developers as the advice women get on when they're pregnant from other people. So he made that analogy, and I'd like to sort of talk about the applicability of generic process advice to projects, less talking about pregnancy, you know, just so you know, just so you have the right expectations.
Well, I'm hanging up right now. I mean, I'm not interested.
That's another podcast. Now, so for the first one, where he says code is a liability, it brings to mind the Star Wars quote where they say fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, and hate leads to suffering. Now, I thought that was a quote from The Empire Strikes Back, but apparently it's actually a quote from The Phantom Menace, so, you know, sorry. But in any case, for our purposes, a more accurate quote would be code leads to bugs, and bugs lead to suffering. Now, this reminds me of a tweet by my co-host, and Wolf, I'm pretty sure you know which tweet I'm talking about here. This will be the third time that we've mentioned it. We mentioned it in episode 9, Alien Reference Counting, and episode 62, Primal Debugging Systems. Yes, Wolf?
When you said my co-host, I had to think of who that was.
You know, just a little sleight of hand there. And the tweet is, in case you have forgotten from 20 episodes ago, where Wolf tweeted, just wrote a two-line function, both lines had a bug in them.
Yep.
And you know, it just completely encapsulates that whole idea, this idea that whenever you're writing code, you think you're writing functionality, but what in fact you're doing is writing bugs. And I think somebody, I have no idea where this comes from, but I'm pretty sure there was a survey of some sort where they tried to estimate how many bugs per lines of code there were, and that it was pretty much one line of bug per code. I could be totally making this up, but I thought I had read that somewhere. I would think it would be really hard to measure.
Yeah.
Right? Because things change a lot. Although I do, you know, you hear people tweet every so often, developers, where they say, oh, it's great, I just got to delete all these lines of code. And you know, people know instinctively that the fewer lines of code you have, probably the fewer bugs you've written. So there's a bunch of reasons why this writing lines of code writes bugs. And I'd like to go through that first. One is that you just make mistakes when you write stuff. You type the wrong thing in, you reference the wrong variable, you just wind up not writing what you mean. And so I was thinking about that. I mean, it's an interesting thing, right? Like, you would think that human beings or creatures would be designed in such a way that the thing that they want to do is the thing that they would do. And yet it just doesn't seem to work out that way. And thinking about it a little further, it occurred to me, I mean, you probably could engineer a better, you know, person or robot or whatever that would be so careful in what they do that you would not have these sorts of mistakes, or you'd have fewer mistakes, right? But I think it comes down to efficiency, because you could also say, I mean, I think there's, and we'll get to process later, but like the process they have for like building space shuttles or whatever, where they, you know, government processes where they, you know, they double check everything, double, triple, quadruple check everything to make sure there are no mistakes, because it's so important that there are no mistakes. And so they slow the process way down. It would be the same thing. Like if you said, well, I'll make sure to go through what I do three or four times, or have, you know, five people review it just to make sure that there are no mistakes in it. Well, you could do that and you'd probably have fewer mistakes, but then you wouldn't go as quickly. And it's the same kind of thing with, say, like memory, right? Where there's memory that is, for example, more resistant to cosmic rays than the memory we have. There's memory that is less error prone than the memory we have, but we don't use it because it's too expensive. And if we had to rely on that memory, we'd have too few computers to really do the stuff that we want to do. So it's kind of the idea that mistakes are the mistakes of the human body are the costs of doing business as a person, so you actually get things done. So, what I thought anyway. So the other one, but there are a couple other things where even if you say, well, I don't make any mistakes like that. I never type in the wrong variable. I never don't type what something different than what my brain is thinking. Other things can happen. And one of them was, this is what came up. I was thinking about your error handling episode because I was thinking about error handling in this case because what I was thinking was, remember, I had this quote a little while ago. I don't remember which episode anymore, but somebody corrected me about it, where I said, happy people are all happy in the same way. Unhappy people are all unhappy in different ways. And that is, in fact, a bastardization of the quote, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And that is the Anna Karenina principle. There's actually an entry for it in Wikipedia from Anna Karenina. The idea here being that if you want to sort a table, if you want to show content in a table, if you want to edit a text field or edit a form of things, while the exact details might not always be the same, it's pretty close. You're generally doing the same thing over and over. But if you then think, well, how am I going to handle errors in my application? That's often something which is much more specific to the app than the functionality in some ways, because errors give you so much more information than you ever want to show to users that you always have to decide on a custom way of dealing with that. So for an application that, for example, it's extremely important that the data gets through like right away, you might want to show a more detailed error message when there are any kind of network failures at all.
Whereas, I mean, we're obviously recording this via Skype, and but there's some line problems, right? It will, when you terminate the call, they'll put up a little panel at the end, like, how exactly was this call bad, right? And that's a different type of error because of Skype's unique profile. It requires, and it logged those errors, but it also wants your own feedback. And like that type of feedback mechanism, usually you think of errors as kind of like things you display to the user, but that's actually where they're trying to incorporate it into their system.
Right, right. It's important for them to get more feedback from the users. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Whereas another system where it's like a game or something where you're just giving information to the server, you're logging information as you go, but you don't necessarily want to interrupt the person's local game as they go. Well, you might just say, well, if there's an intermittent break in network access, well, just don't tell the user about it unless it seems like it's something that's relatively permanent that's really keeping us from doing what we want. Yeah. And I've had apps where we did this, and it was a pain in the butt to do, but it was good because if you just switch networks or something like that, it was totally a better idea to not bug the user for that. But that's something that you then is very specific to that application. You wouldn't want to implement that for everybody. So when you have errors, you may not know right away, in the same way that you know, well, all right, I'm sorting a table, I know how to do that. You may not know right away when you're first writing the code what you're going to do with the errors. So you put a to-do there. And then that to-do doesn't necessarily do anything. You don't necessarily fix it right away because you don't know. And that's extra work you have to do. You have to go back to your PM. You have to go back to your client or whatever to say, well, what exactly do you want to do here? And maybe you want to wait to sort of gather up all the errors that you know are happening in your whole code base before you do that. And then you get to later in the project and maybe things get speeded up because you're running out of time and you don't get back to it. So if you don't get back to those errors and you don't do anything useful with them, you don't do what the application really needs with them, well, then that's a bug. And the last one that I want to talk about is architectural missteps. Because that happens too. Even if you don't make any typing errors, even if you handle all your errors correctly, if you have architected, if you've designed your app wrong, if you have the wrong set of classes for what it actually needs to be done for your application's problem set, then you need to redo that later. And maybe you can't redo that later because you're running out of time. So you have to kind of put hacks in to make it work well enough when you ship. Well, that's probably going to lead to bugs too. And so you have to fix later. So the interesting point of saying, well, code is a liability is this idea. Well, it turns things a bit on their head, because normally when you have bugs, what you think is, well, we just need to fix the bugs, or we need to make the bugs happen less. So you think, well, what kind of languages can we have that will reduce the amount of bugs that a human normally produces? What kind of tools do we have to fix the bugs quickly? What kind of, you know, testers can we put in place that will catch the bugs early so we can fix them early so we don't have them at the end? And this turns it on the head by saying, well, what about if you just write fewer bugs? What if you just write fewer letters code to do that? And the reason people don't generally think in those terms is because we're developers. We think it's our job to write code. And so not writing code is harder. But there are some ideas for it. So that's what I'm going to go through for a little while here. And one of them, I believe, Wolf, you mentioned, although I no longer remember the exact details, in episode 77, prototype-based programming, this idea that you have data-based configuration for writing code, where you, instead of writing the code to do the logic, you write the code to interpret the data, and then the data drives what the code does, at least at the start. Mm-hmm. And in case anyone was unaware, I think most people were probably aware, IB. Is that approach, freeze-dried objects, so to speak. And it's funny, because when I first heard about this concept of freeze-dried objects, it was something that I was a little unclear about. You know, how do you freeze-dry an object? And of course, what you're actually doing is you're just taking all the data that is in there and you take it out. And then you write code such that the data can be put back into it at runtime to do what it needs to do. So it's basically object graph serialization in the same way that like core data is that, but geared towards the UI. You could actually use an interface builder file to instantiate a whole bunch of objects that had no UI based in the middle. I don't know anyone who has ever done that ever.
I do.
You do? All right, now I do know someone. Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff do you do? That
fortunately, I don't want to give it away because it's a topic of a future episode.
Ooh. Okay. Cool. I'd be very interested in when that is realistic to do, because for the most part, if you're going to use serialized object graphs, you would want to use something like core data, which is more geared towards that. But we'll see. So then I was also trying to think of other ways that you have database driven objects, and plists. Mm-hmm. People use plists a lot for this sort of thing, but I couldn't think of other examples offhand, because the problem with that approach is you need to have enough data. You need to be able to use that in enough flexible ways that it's worth writing the code to deserialize it and serialize it out if you need to serialize it out. Right. The need for it needs to overcome the complexity of that piece of code to make that happen. And if it does, then you're good. Mm-hmm. Another way to avoid code would be to use the system functionality, if there is such, for the same thing. Mm-hmm. And this got me thinking about sort of the history of system APIs. Because when you go back far enough, and of course, as a graybeard myself, I can go back this far, the macOS 9 in earlier days, macOS 8, macOS 7, System 6, blah, 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 the toolbox, which was the name of the system APIs, was not a framework. It was a library. Right. And the way this has been described to me, this actually feels a little simplistic. It probably was not quite this cut and dried in that way. But the idea being that the difference between a library and a framework is that the library has functions or methods that you call into, but you're in control of the program execution. And a framework, it controls program execution, and it calls you for the access points that you want to override.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Pretty much, yeah. And so the toolbox library was the same kind of thing. It was a system library, but your app, when it started up, retained control of the program, and it would call out to the library for everything that it needed, up to and including the event loop.
Right.
You ran your own event loop. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was kind of a big deal when Carbon introduced its own APIs for it to control the event loop and call you back. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to have something equivalent to the Coco event loop as well. And it's interesting, I don't know if I've mentioned this in too much detail, although I think I've mentioned it at least once, because I know there was a link to it in the show notes, that I actually worked on interactive fiction interpreter for a system called TADS, where the common code, the C++ cross-platform code that was meant to do all the stuff that was the same for all of the platforms, assumed unbroken thread of execution.
Yeah.
And so I actually had to do a little bit of fancy footwork to make that work under Coco. And I had a, I actually got a paper out of it called Weaving the Leopard's Pelt, Simulating Fibers on OS X. In episode 65, Threads Are Interesting, I guess I mentioned it. And so I'll put a link to that again in the show notes. And the way I did it was actually to just have two threads. And the thread that, that was the common code would actually sleep while it let the system work. And then it would wake itself back up when the system said, hey, you're ready to do more stuff. So it still thought it had full control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that worked. It's not something that most code that I work with anymore needs to worry about. But it is interesting that that was such a common thing back then that people thought to write cross-platform frameworks that had that functionality.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, like the toolbox, you would call out to start up the app and do all these. It was like a set of like 10 system calls. And, you know, over time.
Init windows, init menus, all those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, there was like init quick draw, and then you had to init color quick draw when that
init
came out.
Init graph, yeah.
Yeah. So you had to kind of, it's like anything where you know, you put together a whole bunch of calls like this is that, you know, and I think over the years I'd be like, oh, hey, other people use this call instead of the calls that I'm using, you know, use this extra call. And so, so I would, you know, then you need to change it, or you want to do that. So it's much easier when the system takes care of that for you.
Yeah.
And also, if I'm remembering my history right, I mean, systems used to do a lot less. They used to really give you just the very basic functionality. You know, connecting to the screen, connecting to the disk drive, and that sort of thing. And they would generally add more over time to stuff that now we think of as general basic system functionality, but which was never required to be. So if I remember correctly, like sprites were a later addition. Like you don't need sprites to do graphics programming. It just made it easier. It was a convenience. Better sound APIs. And then in Cocoa, some of the things we just talked about, like Core Data and Cocoa Bindings and NSURL Session. And I have episode numbers where we talked about all these things. I'm not going to mention it now. One of the things we haven't mentioned that's new in the latest versions of the OS is NS Progress. Mm-hmm. Wolf, have you used this yet?
Not angered, no, but I have my eye on it. I'll probably be using it real soon.
Right. So there's a blog post by I'm gonna butcher names. Oh well, Ol Begman, that I'll put a link to in the show notes, where he talks about what it's about, and he says it's mostly documented for a certain value of documented in the 10.9 release notes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's they say it's a standard mechanism for reporting progress of long running tasks. And it's got a whole bunch of details about that. But what's interesting, right, is this idea that you need a standard system component to help you with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would you need that? Well, I suppose sometimes you need that. But it's even more interesting because they say they have four goals for it. They say they want loose coupling, they want composability, they want reusability, they want usability. And when I think of, well, how do I connect like this task in my data model, in my model, to the UI, I think of something very simple. There are very simple mechanisms that will let you do this. Notifications, bubbling things up in other fairly simple ways. I wouldn't think you'd need a system component for it. But it's funny because they not only said, well, yes, you need a system component for it, but we need kind of this relatively elaborate, relatively heavily thought through and has its own philosophy about how it's going to work. System component just for this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to a degree, I think, well, do they not have enough other stuff to do? but it's also, you know, it's a progression right there. Well, you know, you've taken care of some of the simpler things that you might want to do. You've taken care of more general purpose connection between your model and your UI. The Cocoa Bindings, I'm sure they thought they had kind of solved that or gotten a lot of way through the general purpose case. So now we're going to move on to more special cases? I don't know. But what it makes me think here, though, is that when you say I'm going to have the system do something for me, you're almost always in better shape when that thing you want the system to do for you is specific and bounded. So, you know, maybe NS Progress is actually a good idea for that. Actually, the thing they're doing with NS Progress is they say they have nested progress, a tree of progress objects for you to mm-hmm. use. And so I think that's where they say, well, here's where we can help you by giving you the structure for this. But what I say is the more complicated you make this functionality, where it's trying to serve a great number of complex clients, the more problems you're likely to run into. And we've had a couple of episodes about Core Data, actually episode 1.
Yeah,
and episode 52, And I think the general idea for Core Data, for me, the general takeaway point for Core Data is it's really hard to use in and of itself well. So when you have this thing where you say, oh, the system can handle this for you, that will only save your bugs if it doesn't also introduce its own bugs because of the complexity of its own implementation and because of the way it's trying to be sort of something for everyone. And yet, of course, it can't be because it was written in a finite amount of time by a certain small number of people. And so, you know, you have to think about that trade-off of, will I be adding more bugs by using this functionality that someone else wrote over using my own simpler implementation? And I know I don't have a link to it at this point, although I think I could find one pretty easily. Brent Simmons has been talking a lot about Core Data and other topics on his blog recently. Mm-hmm. He has been going a bit, having a bit of a revival, I think, of his blog recently.
I think he's single-handedly trying to bring blogs back.
Yes. And it might work. It just might work. And he has said recently that he finally just decided, well, I'm not going to use Core Data. I'm going to use a simpler implementation. I don't remember if it was something he wrote or if he was going to that simpler object model thing, the F something something. Is that ringing a bell?
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. So we're all going to have our own weaker versions of Core Data soon.
Well, and he kind of said, well, this might just be my way of doing things. But I actually think it's not necessarily a bad idea. If you have very specific things that you want and you don't need everything that Core Data gives you, then maybe your own implementation would be better. He mm-hmm. was in particular mentioning that he wanted that whole mark all as red
right.
functionality, mm-hmm. which is very hard in Core Data because they decided not to expose that thing directly from the mm-hmm. the SQLite layer to the top level. They decided not to allow that, not to increase their complexity by allowing that. But then, you know, then you don't have it. Mm-hmm. So let's see. And something very similar to using system functionality is then using third-party libraries as well. And, you know, we've talked about AF networking in episode 71. Another example, which is much simpler, is the reachability library from Apple.
Yeah.
And it's actually, even though it's simple and even though it's in theory something relatively specific in the same way that I said so, it's actually a pretty crappy library, I think. And I also think that they probably should have, because it is something that's so specific, they really should have put more of that functionality into the system, precisely because what everybody has to do is take that library and then add their own stuff on top of it, because it isn't really as full-featured as it should be.
Right, that's the SC reachability stuff, right?
SC reachability,
like for system configuration reachability.
I just thought it was called reachability. I didn't think it had a
maybe I was using the lower level API for that, because that's exactly what you want to do, right? Use the lowest possible API. No, kids, don't do that at home. but it's quite possible I was using it before it even had Objective-C wrapper on it.
Okay. Okay. We might need to compare notes afterwards. So, but the third-party libraries, I mean, again, they're very similar to the system libraries in that you have to decide whether you want this added complexity that you didn't write instead of the maybe simpler stuff that you do write that takes more time, that might have more bugs because it's not as battle-tested, but with the added risk of obsolescence and incompatibility. So that's something, I know we've talked about this before, exactly what to do in those cases here. And I think... and that's also the danger with things like CocoaPods, where they have this whole big system, but will, you know, if people don't keep maintaining it, keep making it work with the current versions of Xcode and with the system, then it won't work in the future because Apple is moving fairly quickly. So that's something you have to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, didn't you have a crack about Alcatraz? Which is the Xcode plugin manager?
Yeah, well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely one of those things. I believe it broke on Xcode 5, and they recently, have basically had to do a rewrite on it. And yeah, that's part of the chores, right? That's part of the prices that needs to be paid, is to keep up with this stuff.
Keep up with the stuff, right. So you need to sort of decide, well, are the people who are maintaining this people who are going to keep maintaining this? And of course, you know, it's not like they have some sort of obligation to you, you know, oh my God, you can sue them or something like that. You're taking the risks upon yourself, really, whenever you do this, but it's good to sort of think through it, I think. And then the last one that I wanted to talk about was you know, we have all these things to say, well, we want the same functionality, but can we do it with less code on our part? Well, you also might decide that you just want less functionality. And that comes to Michael Jurwitz's minimum viable product post that he did in that very brief window of time, I think after he left BlackPixel and before he went back to Apple. So he has a post in March of last year called You Need an MVP. And instead of most valuable player, he meant minimum viable product. And one quote from that is, you don't need all the features under the sun. You don't need technical excellence, assuming you also avoid technical debt. You need to solve a worthwhile problem in a delightful, thoughtful, and simple way. So, and I believe we've also mentioned this in passing various times, this idea that, you know, you don't, you want to, if you're going to make a product, you want to have focus on it. And again, that's something that Apple seems to do pretty well, that they say, you know, we're not going to give you everything you would ever want in a version one. We're going to give you, you know, the bare minimum that we can get away with. That's good. That's going to convince you that you want to use it and then want to keep using it. And then you can add more to it later. And that also is, and I think that's more important when you have a smaller team, although it's also important when you have a larger team, really. And it's also an important way to then keep your team small so you don't have the costs of having too many people and having complexity there as well. But overall, I think my take on this is the Albert Einstein quote. Although, in fact, it is not an Albert Einstein quote. It is merely attributed to him. I think you know which one I mean. Yes. He never said the exact words. He actually said a more complex quote than what this quote is, which is, I think, also kind of funny, that everything should be made as simple as possible, and but no simpler. Mm-hmm. And, that, you know, obviously, actually making that decision is up to you. But, you know, I think you want to be careful that you're not overbuilding your code and you're not choosing third-party or system libraries that are too complex for what your needs are. But then don't do too little either. And I don't know how useful that is, but that's about where I'm coming to with it.
I'll just chime in here. I did a quick search on the reachability stuff, yeah. And it is the SC reachability is a CF style API. Maybe one thing that's confusing you is Apple also ships sample code called reachability.
Right.
Confusing, and that also includes basically Objective-C kind of wrapper for it, but it's not, but the frameworks themselves. So it's kind of this middle ground, right, where Apple's right. giving you code, but it's not actually part of the frameworks.
Yeah, I would almost consider that to be a third-party library, just because it's not in the system. It's
yeah,
actually
especially, especially if you know where these sample projects that often run by interns and aren't always well maintained.
Right.
And so it's not, even though it is from Apple's own site, they're not always super supported. Or I was going to say it's not officially blessed, but it is officially blessed, but it's not really gold standard.
Right. And I do think, though, that everybody uses the sample code. Every project I've ever used uses the sample code over using the library directly.
I should also point out that it's not all the sample codes written by interns. Some of them were written by extremely competent Apple internal engineers that are helping you try to use the framework that they've also written, and many things that they couldn't ship along for the ride for various reasons. Like I know, a lot of sample codes have been written by Quinn the Eskimo and stuff like that.
Right.
So,
yeah. Not an intern. Yes. No. The interesting part is knowing the difference between the two, knowing which ones were written by which people.
Yeah.
So let's see. So moving on to number two. Actually, do you want to chime in now anymore, or you want to wait to the end? Or
you know, you still have a few more bullet points. Yeah. I have some feedback, but let's see how far you get.
Okay. So the second one is ship the right bugs. And I think from my Apple experience, that invokes something very specific in my mind, which is not, you know, write some bugs in their code so that you can ship with them, right? Mm-hmm. No, it means... Right. Having the right idea of which bugs you fix at which time. Mm-hmm. And I think my Apple experience has really helped me here, because Apple's managers were really hard asses about punting bugs. They had an idea of convergence, which is the idea that you look at how many bugs you have for your project, and if it's not going down by a certain I may be butchering this, but if it's not going down by a certain percentage over time, then you're probably going to miss your ship date if it's not going down, right? Mm-hmm. And so you know, if it isn't going down to the right percentage, then you need to do something about it. And that could mean punting features. That could mean deciding to punt more bugs as you go to get it in line. there's the idea of closing down a project where you say, well, we don't want the risk of doing any more work on it. So we're going to shut it down now, and you're not going to do any more on it. Not because you couldn't, but because of that risk factor. So after a certain point, you know, no P3 bugs, no bugs that are kind of the lowest level. And then after that, there's a certain point where you say, well, no P2 bugs. And after that, you know, only critical P1 bugs. And that was pretty much the way every OS release went for the time that I was there.
And P is probably stands for priority.
Priority, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen that. That's also, I think that's the way Jira does it. That's the way other things do it as well. The idea of the P1, P2, P3 seems to be a fairly common way to describe it. And what's interesting is that other companies and other projects that I've done, it's never been as strict as that, and it's never been as well organized as that. Should I be mentioning that? Anyway. and it's interesting, just the different ways people think about it. I was on a project, and I will not mention which project. I was on a project where the idea was zero bugs. That's it, just zero bugs. We can't ship with any bugs. So every time we found a new bug during our testing, everything would stop to fix that bug. And we'd have to start our testing all over again. And we have, you know, it took us months to ship. Mm-hmm. And that always kind of frustrated me that was the idea, because we could have shipped sooner, we could have shipped a lot sooner, and it would have been about as good a product because it's not like several weeks of testing is going to find all the obscure bugs that ever happen in your project. And it's not like every bug that you ever find is a showstopper. You've got to decide the benefits of adding more risk for fixing a bug versus, you know, who's actually going to be hit by it. So let's see, what do I have written down here? Like if it's a rare crasher, it crashes, but it's really rare. It's really under very specific, unusual circumstances. And the fix is really high risk. You've got to go in and you've got to change things at a very low level that affects all sorts of places in your code. You know, maybe you'll decide, no, we can ship with that for version one. We'll fix it afterwards, but we're not gonna stop shipping for that. Whereas, and this is actually something that I definitely saw at Apple, you know, a very visually distinctive bug, something that everyone's gonna see, oh my God, it's gonna make us look so bad, but it's got a high risk fix. Well, maybe you're gonna ship with that, because the downside of it is only cosmetic. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that. Whereas if there's something that is pretty obscure but also has a low risk fix for it, well, then you're more likely to fix that bug at that point. And that's the idea. You want to ship the right bugs such that the fewest people are impacted by the bugs once you ship, and you have manageable risk. It's not like you have no risk, but you really want to think about what it's going to do to your project. Like, because, you know, the thing that you really don't want to have happen is, well, I'm fixing a bug that somebody thought was really important but wasn't really all that important 2 weeks before we ship, and that adds a lot of risk to the project. And so then after you ship, one of that fix causes a much bigger problem that you weren't able to find because you didn't have that many time to test. That's going to kill you. That's going to hurt you quite a bit more than, oh, let's just not fix this not that important bug. And the other phrase that comes to mind here is not an Einstein quote, but is a quote from my writing days, which is kill your darlings. And in my case, what this means is that, again, at Apple, we had a lot of times where people were lobbying to fix bugs, lobbying, oh my God, this is going to make us look so bad. We need to fix it. We need to fix it. We need to fix it. Well, no, you don't need to fix it. You know, we still have a schedule that's going to introduce too much risk. No, we'll fix it next time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that was the right choice.
Yeah.
So
it seems like a very kind of adult thing.
Yeah, no, it involves you being able to make difficult choices and analyze things and you know, getting all the data together. And it's hard. It's hard to do, but it's a good idea. And so let me see here. Yeah, why don't I wrap this up pretty quick. The last one was about code processes or mm-hmm. project development Pregnancies, processes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. John Siracusa talked about this recently in a recent Accidental Tech Podcast episode. I can't remember which one exactly, but he said that he had seen the case where successful executives were writing these books saying, I'm successful, so here's what I had for breakfast, and you should have that for breakfast. Mm-hmm. You know, I jog every day. Okay, so you should jog every day. Well, no, that's probably not what led to your success. What led to your success was, you know, a certain amount of luck and a certain amount of, you know, getting in at the right time, having the right idea in the right field, and that might not have anything to do with what you're doing. So, more particularly about tech, a lot of times they have these ideas where they say, well, here was a small team that was successful, so let's look at what they did and apply what they did to everybody else. Well, no, because there are so many different variations to that. You might have a small team versus a large team. You might have a team where people like each other versus where people hate each other. You might have a certain requirements for the project, for the app, that are just very different from project to project. So expecting then, you know, one set of rules to apply for everyone, it's just not very useful, I don't think. What's interesting here is that I've seen a lot of agile trappings in the projects that I've worked on, people having Scrum, people having sprints, things like that. But it's funny, there's a term that I think, again, I got from Accidental Tech Podcast, where they called it Scrummerfall.
Right.
Right, where it's basically the waterfall process where you're coming up with the design ahead of time, you're coming up with the requirements ahead of time, coming up with just about everything ahead of time, or as you go, but before you start working on it. But then you have the trappings of Agile. You have, you know, Scrum, you have sprints, you have everything that makes it seem like you're doing something more like Agile, but you're not. And it's interesting because I think I would say that it's probably not good to fool yourself that you're doing Agile when you're not. But on the other hand, not trying to have the full Agile experience when it's not Agile is actually the right way to go. So, you know, if for political reasons you have to say, oh, but we're doing Agile when you're not, sure, go ahead. But use the processes that are actually going to get you to the end of your thing. I don't think I've ever actually, I mean, Agile is something extremely specific. And actually there was also a post recently, God, I've completely forgotten about it right now. But there was a post recently where one of the original people who worked on Agile, who came up with it, was, you know, again, kind of talking about how everybody thinks they're doing Agile, but they're not. And I'll put that in the show notes. I can't think of the guy's name, unfortunately. But, you know, this idea that the reason we're not doing Agile in most of the projects I've been working on is because, again, we do have requirements that can't be changed. You know, I think Agile was about kind of being very flexible, but that requires you to be able to be flexible. And that's very rare, actually, that I've seen. So you can't do it. So you need to do something else. And, you know, I guess you do what you can. Now, I would still want you to have as little process as you can get away with. It really comes back to the same thing I said before, which is as simple as possible, but no simpler. Don't impose processes before you need them. And I think it's the same thing. Developers tend to overbuild when they're first building something. I think developers who have discovered that process can be helpful also tend to overprocess what they do to say, okay, now here are the rules. We're going to do it like this. And you don't need to do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that's pretty much all I have. For that.
Okay.
So, and we're running a little bit low on time, so I'll let you give your feedback then, Wolf.
Okay. I don't know if you heard the latest episode of Accidental Tech Podcast number 56, where there's a little bit of follow-up on the
software. Agile stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Little, and I didn't finish it, but I did hear.
At least the beginning part is where I really think it was Seekers that did a good job in terms of kind of explaining. He put it in a way that I hadn't thought of before, which I think is a good insight about how you have the kind of this boundaries barrier between like the modeling the physical world and kind of with, and we know these models are problematic and not complete, but they're pretty much up to the task of the type of things we do. But once we go into the software world where we have these binary bits and then we build, it's no longer the realm of humans figuring out reality. It's basically humans building reality. And the problem is that it's knowable and it's also mutable. He doesn't use the term mutable, but, and so these things change and they have edge cases and it's, you know, hence the name of this bloody podcast, right? So I really like the way he put it there. So, so going back into kind of like the code as a liability type aspect that you were mentioning. Yeah, totally. It's, obviously, you made a little bit of a comment there about features, but if you can ship a simpler product, if you that's part of the liability is that if you are bringing a new person up to speed on a project, if it's a simpler app, if it's a simple project, then it's less cognitive work to get them even up to speed. It's more likely you can find talent to fulfill the work that needs to be done. As things get more and more complicated, the air gets progressively more rare. And also, a big aspect of this is kind of the maintenance. You kind of touched on with libraries versus frameworks, and if basically if you can kind of delegate responsibility to the system, then you're probably in better shape than if you didn't. There are some pretty huge caveats to that, but you know, in general, that's the case.
Yeah.
It also reminds me of this was also mentioned on Accidental Type podcast, but this podcast called Script Notes, where they're discussing this supposedly terrible app called Final Draft, which is apparently the industry standard for like screen scripts or something.
Screenplays, yeah.
Screenplays, thank you. And one of the things is that, if you have a 500,000 lines of code app type thing, and Apple says, oh, you know that Carbon thing you wrote it in, now we're doing Cocoa. This is actually one of the things that the CEO were kind of called out, is that they weren't doing their job really keeping track of the platform that they actually ship for, but they're like, oh, you know, Apple doesn't want us to do this Carbon thing anymore. And Apple wasn't that bad. It could be pretty bad, but they weren't bad in that respect. I mean, they gave plenty of warning for this type of stuff. But I mean, look at this app. It was a perfectly functional Carbon app, and now it has to be Cocoa. But this is kind of you must be thus tall to ride type thing, that this is what you sign up for. So obviously, if you have if that code that your 500,000 lines for Carbon, maybe it's a 250,000 line Cocoa app, but now you need all that 500,000 lines that basically kind of specify your product in excruciating detail. Now you need to make that happen for Cocoa.
Yeah. maybe we should amend it to say Carbon code is a liability, because it really is, right? Yeah.
Well, even Cocoa code, because Cocoa is not. I mean, it has had a pretty good track run. What is from the early '90s and keeps on chugging along. But eventually, it's going to run out of steam, and it will not be the right way to write software anymore. And so many apps are kind of like flashes in the pan, kind of their era type stuff. And so if it goes down with the ship, goes down with the ship. And we saw that a lot when we migrated from System 7, 68K. To PowerPC, earlier OS 10, and now with iPhone and iPads and with ARM chips, it's like, some of the software, like, you look back, like, I can't run that software anymore, but I guess it doesn't really matter because we've kind of moved on from that. But if you actually want to bring your software along for the ride, like BB Edit, Barebones has been doing a phenomenal job with putting in the time, making it happen year in, year out, to keep on moving ahead with the system. And that's not free.
Right. So, I mean, the simpler your app is, the less time you need to spend doing
that. Right.
And I also think that there's a lot of, people do talk a lot about following Apple's best practices precisely because a lot of what Apple recommends you do is for the sake of not having to do less work in the future to keep up with system updates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with your ship the right bug section, the idea of you're taking the hard line on the zero bugs type thing, like the first thing that sprung in mind when you mentioned that is that I wondered, it seems to me like a side channel would almost immediately develop for that. Is that okay? We have the official bug tracker, but maybe I'm just going to have this pad of paper here that I'm going to write down the bugs I know about. Did that actually happen, or can you not talk about it?
No, I don't remember anything like that happening. That would be, I think, if it were a large enough company, that might have happened. But maybe it did, in the sense that maybe not file this bug, because then it would have to, someone will stop everything if this bug is filed. I don't remember. I would not be surprised if that happened with more simple things, but I don't remember.
I'm concerned that it's like I could totally see that you're a day away from shipping and you notice that this icon is a pixel off and you're not going to put that into the system. Yeah. And obviously that's kind of an exaggerated scenario, but that's so easy to these little nitty things that are so easy to that totally should not hold up you know, shipping. As you said, the cosmetic type stuff. You know, cosmetics are kind of weird because, like, for users, this is perhaps more disconcerting than perhaps a data corruption bug, which is kind of, you know, you save your file and it's been trashed and you don't even know it and you find out later. But if I'm using this app, it's like, you know, kind of is drawing lines where it shouldn't, and I'm much more suspicious of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was this in the olden days, we had the EO modeler, which is kind of like Core Data's entity's data modeler type thing.
The data modeler, yeah.
And mm-hmm. In the port from OpenStep to early Mac OS X, it had this like some sort of drawing bug where you actually while you're dragging around your entities, you actually could do a Photoshop style kind of blur effect or smearing effect.
Yeah, right.
And I love showing off because it like scared the hell out of you, because what are you doing to your entities? but it was just purely cosmetic, because when you let go, it all looked good again.
Yeah
but yes, I we're already running along, so, and that does it for me.
Okay, all right, thanks, and we'll see you next time.